Outside, we couldn't see it from our vantage point.
Welcome, everyone, to our Vantage Point, the Retro Wrestling Podcast. This is episode number 7, isn't it, Quinn?
Wow, number 7.
Number 7. We are here joined by a very, very special guest today. That would be the former Net Cop himself, Scott Keith. How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing good, thanks. I got plenty of Americans living in my basement now.
More on the way.
Yeah.
Four on the way, yeah. Everybody moved in last night. It's hell on my Wi-Fi, but, you know, that's okay.
So, folks, Quinn and I have over 40 years of combined fandom. Scott, how long have you been watching wrestling?
I started in 1986 officially, and then for a few years before that. So, given my age now, I'm at around 30 years, I'd say.
Wow. So today, folks, we've got 70 years of combined wrestling fandom on the line with
the
you.
The years are piling up on this show.
So same format as usual, but we've got a very special guest with us, Scott Keith from the Blog of Doom, formerly of Rantsylvania. Quinn and I have been reading you, Scott, since the Rantsylvania days, believe it or not.
That was a long time ago.
The Smarks, obviously,
right.
all throughout that 411. And now, where else are you, Scott, right now? Where can people find you?
I'm also writing for thesportingnews.com.
That's right.
As well. InsidePulse.com as well. I'm on there, too. So
nice.
Technically, I write for WhatCulture.com as well, but I haven't really gotten around to doing anything for them for a while. But I'm still part of the staff there, too.
Gotcha.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And the Podcast of Doom, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the Podcast of Doom's kind of on the back burner right now, but yes, that's maybe someday we'll fire up again.
Yeah, cool. So for our first segment, I am going to throw a missed opportunity out there. I'll start with you, Scott, and then Quinn, of course, feel free to chime in and take you back to 1997 now.
Okay.
Ken Shamrock, and here's why I think it was a missed opportunity. You had a guy that was dubbed at the time from the world of UFC. Was the baddest man on the planet. There's that Mike Tyson. The world's most dangerous man.
ABC. The world's most dangerous.
Right. And they brought him in, and the way they brought him in was cool. I liked it. He was the ref in that submission match at WrestleMania 13. And they had him punk out, I guess, a few jobbers for a little bit. And he had a pretty cool match against Vader, I think, at the May of 97 in your house.
I think he
beat
up Lawler or something, too.
I don't think he beat up Lawler.
Like, ankle locked him?
No, Billy Gunn. Okay. Rockabilly Gunn. But then, a few months later, he's in a loser-eats-dog-food match. And he had, like, a really crappy world title match against Shawn Michaels. And to me, it seemed like they had a lot of potential with him, and they only kind of half-used it. I don't know if that was maybe a booking limitation or a Shamrock limitation. So, Scott, I'll start with you. What do you think of Ken Shamrock's run in WWF? Was it a missed opportunity?
Oh, yeah, it was a huge missed opportunity. I'm an unabashed fan of Robo Shamrock from late 98 and early 99, in that period when he permanently snapped and became, you know, the unstoppable killing machine. I thought that was actually tremendous. Yeah. That was a really good use of him. And I mean, it's not like he was a super green worker or anything like that. Like, he was, you know, he had experience as Vince Torelli before that. And actually, as I'm going through the Wrestling Observer flashbacks right now on Blog of Doom, cheap plug. That's one of the things that is coming up right now is his experience as Vince Torelli doing the indies and everything like that. So, I mean, he was around, certainly. But, yeah, I thought it was definitely a huge missed opportunity. And actually, so did Eric Bischoff, because one of the things that he was famous for noting is that Goldberg was his attempt to show the WWF the proper way to use somebody like Ken Shamrock.
Is that right?
So, that's interesting. Yeah, I never knew that.
Yeah, that was the idea with what Goldberg was supposed to be, like a hybrid fighter like that, like somebody who was tapping into that kind of MMA style, because Bischoff was obviously a big fan for, you know, karate guys and
and
martial arts, right? So that's what he was trying to recreate. But I mean, like, it's amazing they had, you know, at the time, this top UFC star basically dropped into their laps with ready-made stuff,
right? And, led him there, by the way? You said he was Vince Torelli first. Was that his name? I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, so he was when he first started out, that was the name that he was using on the indie circuit, was Vince Torelli. And then he wrestled a couple of years before changing his name to Ken Wayne Shamrock, obviously. He moved over to Japan where he was doing the fighting over there, and that's kind of where he started making his name for himself, doing the shoot fighting.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was, but he definitely had experience in the ring before he came to the WWF. It's not like he was, you know, he had never been in there, I think, before. I think he seemed to have forgotten everything that he had, yeah, he had learned, but yeah, like he started in 1990. So, I mean, he'd actually been around for a while in the business before he came into there. But so, I mean, yeah, it was like, it was basically a proto Brock Lesnar that was dropped into their laps at the time. And they just didn't, you know, UFC just wasn't a big thing.
No, it wasn't. No. I mean, Vince even promoted UFC at the time, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. So it's like they didn't really know what they had there, you know, because, you know, imagine, if you will, like, you know, Brock Lesnar at that time running rampant, right, everybody. That's kind of what it could have been with Ken Shamrock, I think, because there was no tapping out, right? Ken Shamrock was basically the one that introduced the mechanics.
Yes, so, yes, tapping I out, do remember rest. That. There was none of that before him.
No, it was, do you submit, you know, or shake I your head, yes, or whatever. I quit, yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it really kind of, it was something that really could have kind of redefined the style and merged things together. But as it was, he just suddenly became another guy, basically. And there was a couple of glimpses of it where he was doing, like, the Lion's Den matches with Owen Hart, which were really good, I thought.
I love that, yeah. What did you like that, Scott?
Yeah, no, I really like that one. Yeah, it was really, well, the big cage at SummerSlam, it was a pretty cool thing. It was a nice difference. Yeah,
yeah. Quinn, what did you think of that?
I don't know about that.
No, why?
There was something about that cage that was a little goofy to me. Like, I know it's Owen Hart, and he's a technical wrestler, but I don't know. It just seemed a little silly.
It was, if I recall, I haven't seen SummerSlam 98 in a little bit. It was a bit of like Owen was kind of still working like a pro wrestling style, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Shamrock was going for more of a UFC feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could see why people liked it.
Owen was doing
it,
like tornado DDTs off the cage. And yeah. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Did he? Please tell me he Irish whipped him into the cage at one point.
I don't remember, but yeah.
That match was, yeah, I remember thinking that was a little silly at the time, but I can also see like why it was cool. But I think a lot of that for me was that we didn't have UFC in this New Jersey area where we're from. Like,
that's true.
Like
I hadn't heard of it really.
Well, it's been banned here since like this year.
Oh really?
Like, yeah, you can't, we didn't really have it in the Northeast in our area. So when he came in, I mean, honestly, his entire rep to me was that on Good Morning America they said he was dangerous. Like,
well, see, I had never heard of the guy. I remember them interviewing him. I believe it was at the Raw that, maybe you would know, Scott, maybe not, that was at the Manhattan Center, right? You know, yep. Maybe in February. You're right. They interviewed him.
Yep,
I think it
absolutely.
Was Lawler interviewed
the front
him.
Row, yep. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And Lawler was acting like he was his big friend with him and
yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. So
that's what I was saying before about Lawler.
Well, yeah,
I remember him beating up Lawler. When
he didn't
first
beat him up. I think he just insulted him.
Okay.
Or in whatever.
Yeah, never really went anywhere, but yeah. That's...
Okay, okay. Yeah, misremembering that. But...
Now, Scott, I have a question for you while we're on the topic of Shamrock. I seem to recall reading in one of your old rants that Shamrock was never particularly well-liked in Canada. Is that true?
That is absolutely true, yes.
Any idea why?
Yeah, he was always opposing like Owen Hart and Bret Hart and guys like that. And, yeah, it just happened that... you know, every time he was up in Canada, he was fighting a member of the Hart family, and people just got very, very resentful of him. I mean, if you watch like the breakdown pay per view from Hamilton,
yep,
that one in '97, right? People are just violently opposed to him in the cage. It's the funniest thing, and he did a house show in Edmonton that I was there at, and we were taunting him the whole time, and it was fantastic. And yeah, one of my favorite memories was Owen Hart had him in the sharpshooter, and Ken was fighting it off, and he was actually flipping us off in the front row at the same time.
That's awesome.
We were yelling at him. So yeah, no, it was great. But yeah, Canada has always had this bitterness against Ken Shamrock. And I think the other thing too is it's because he was also on the Canadian Stampede team for the for Team US. That's, you know,
yes.
he was part of that as well.
Yep.
So, yeah,
Cold and all that, yeah.
Yep.
So he's got a lot of strikes against him up here.
So,
I feel like we might have forgotten him by now, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, we'll have to send him up there. maybe this month, actually. Maybe before January 20th, we can send him up there for you guys.
I mean, I wanted to say just that as far as a missed opportunity is concerned, I felt like his face run was kind of disappointing.
I agree, but I know Scott is in agreement with us, or maybe at least me. Robo Shamrock, that heel run.
The heel run
was awesome.
And I even remember liking him in the corporation for some reason. Yeah. I can't explain to you why, but I just did.
Because every corporation needs a dangerous man. That's what Vince McMahon did.
Well, I also like that he was with Big Boss Man at the time.
Yeah,
like
the most evil man in the company.
The man that makes people eat their own dogs. Like great A. Like, I just remember thinking that's like when he was booked properly.
Right.
Absolutely.
That was. That four-month run that he had as an Intercontinental Champion.
Right.
Then that was weird. I think they beat the Outlaws, Scott, maybe, for the tag titles, which was weird.
That's right, yep.
Yeah.
And they had them for I felt like they had them for a while, but it probably wasn't because it was the Attitude
Era. Yeah, it was 99.
But,
it was 99. No one
but
had
I was also like, you know, I was also like 12 or something. So like.
No, I mean, on the subject of the face, you know, the babyface run being the missed opportunity, it literally was a huge missed opportunity because, I mean, this Bret Hart was wanting to drop the title to Shamrock instead of Shawn Michaels, right?
That's true.
So, I mean, by all rights, Shamrock should have ended up with that title in December. So, I mean, that's another one where, you know, circumstances kind of robbed him almost of getting that belt because, you know, it could have ended up with him very easily, and in which case that would have been, you know, totally fine usage of him. So, you know, blame Montreal, I guess. Or
yeah,
blame.
Yeah.
speaking of December 97, Scott, did Michaels not want to work with him, or was that match just bad because Shamrock wasn't feeling?
Oh, yeah, that.
Do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, I think it was just because, because Shamrock just was kind of
crappy.
Wrist was kind of green, and Sean wanted to get a good match out of him, kicking and screaming, basically. Like, literally kicking and literally screaming. Because you could hear him yelling spots halfway across the ring every time. Clothesline! You know? Like,
You're right,
I mean, I know it's a long time ago now, but I feel like even as a kid, when that was at the DX pay-per-view.
Yeah, that was DX.
I felt like that match, like, the outcome was like a foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
It was like, it just felt like Michaels was so fresh as being the champion. It felt like Ken Shamrock could have been like a big deal against him, right?
Yeah. Yep. It should have been. It absolutely should have been a big deal.
But it's the first match after the screw job, and it's just like, you know he's going to roll over.
It's at a dog shit pay-per-view.
Yeah.
And it's just a weird period of time for them. I wish they could have held that match off, maybe, but who the hell knows?
Yeah. It might have been better for Rumble, right?
Yeah, like it feels like if that had been today, it would have been a setup pay-per-view where they did the dog shit finish and then, you know, came back and Rumble with a bigger one. But then they wanted to stick Owen in there and move into other things. And it was just, things were very, very disorganized after Montreal for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And they just wanted to, you know, they were trying different things. And it was really strange. But yeah, it definitely feels like they could have had a more cohesive way to go through it with Shamrock. But they wanted to move him to Rocky, and they wanted to move Owen to Triple H and do all this stuff.
Right.
And who knows what Sean was doing. So, yeah, it was kind of.
So, Scott, I'm going to walk the folks at home listening through this first. So Shamrock actually then, after this heel turn in late 98, he turned face around April of 99. It was part of the whole Stephanie McMahon, where to Stephanie, that whole storyline with The Undertaker. And he was like defending Vince, who happened to be a face at the time. It's Russo, folks. It just things happened.
Refresh my memory, but wasn't like some of the corporation like kind of facey at that time?
No.
Because of like
Shamrock.
It was just Shamrock.
Well, unless Scott remembers better, but I think it was just Shamrock.
That's when Shamrock split off and joined the Union, right?
Isn't that right.
Yes. Okay.
The Union.
Because I was just thinking, because like I had said an episode or two ago, it's like that Russo era is so like...
It's hard to follow,
it's so
man.
Hard to... Like, I remember watching all
God,
of it.
Oh, God, tell me about it. I went back when I watched the first episode of SmackDown on the network. And I was just like this. I was watching it at the time in 99, and I'm going through it, and it's just like I was just completely lost by half an hour into the show.
Yeah.
I'm like, who the fuck are these people, and what are they doing? And
Dave
McMahon's got the corporation out there, and then like, and you know, and but he's fighting with other members in the corporation, and he's fighting with Vince. And who hates each other? I don't understand.
It's a weird time because you remember being there, but like you're like, what is all this?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah.
Whereas I'm sure most of us could recite the card of WrestleMania 3 in order.
Exactly.
You know, and what was going on in the 80s and the early 90s. But man, you hit that Russo era and things really start to fall apart. Scott, I want to ask you, my memory of Shamrock at the time, towards the end of 99, I think it was around September, is he was supposed to have a match with Chris Jericho, I believe, at the September 99 pay-per-view. I guess that was Unforgiven. And then he wasn't there. Jericho fought X-Pac, and Shamrock seemed to be gone. Do you have any – what happened with Shamrock?
I don't even remember. He might have wanted to go back to fighting, but yeah, no, I don't. I don't have any. I know he was also injured around that time as well. But
what I remember the most about that was he disappeared. And
he
then,
just disappeared.
And then the first thing I heard of him is I was in a FYE or something.
FYE?
No joke. I was in an FYE in a mall, and I saw him on a UFC DVD from in the early 2000s. And that was the next time I ever saw him again.
Scott, do you have FYE up in Canada, or did you? You know what that is?
No,
it's just a DVD store.
It's like a DVD music store. It stands for your entertainment.
we actually have very little for music DVD stores anymore. We have one called HMV, and that is pretty much the extent of it.
It's getting that way down.
Yeah,
here
it's getting that way here now too.
But I'm thinking back in the DVD like Prime or whatever.
Right. I do know that it's I guess it's easy to say. This is what they could have done with Ken Shamrock, having the perspective of like a Brock Lesnar now or even a Goldberg from back then, what Bischoff did. I don't know that I guess anyone was really thinking that back then, except maybe Eric Bischoff himself, would have had better ideas. But let's brainstorm here. Maybe, Scott, I'll open with you. What do you think, you know, hindsight being 2020, obviously, but what do you think they could have done differently with Shamrock, or what would you have done with him from his debut, you know, onward, if you had the book?
I would have done just like they do with Brock Lesnar now, like just have him go in there and just plow through guys and ankle lock them until they submit, and build him up as the unstoppable killer. It's always been a money thing in wrestling. Hulk Hogan lived off it for years and years. Yeah. I mean, I guess the major problem is that they wouldn't have had somebody to, you know, oppose. I mean, they could have actually, Steve Austin, I guess, would have been a logical guy, have him run through everybody and, you know, build him up for Austin the way they wanted to do with Steve Williams. You know, I think it would have worked. It would have worked totally well. And, you know, hey, you have that dynamic of the outsider coming in from UFC who doesn't play by the rules of wrestling.
Right.
The same way that Brock Lesnar did. Right. Yeah. It would have been great.
I was going to say, too, though, would the politics of the time allowed for a Ken Shamrock to just plow through wrestlers? Like, I feel like Vince would never allow that.
Like,
because
the real fighting
beating his fake wrestlers that he wants to look so impressive, you know?
Well, I mean, at the time, Vince was in a real bad way. So it's, true. You know, hey, he was up for trying a lot of crazy stuff that you wouldn't have expected.
That
at
is
the time.
True.
That's a good point, yeah. You know what? I think ultimately the memories of Shamrock that I do look back on and I like is I like that, like Scott said, that 4-month run. That wasn't a missed opportunity. That was a great way to book him. He was just like this crazy-ass unstoppable guy.
Yeah, no, that was good.
And I did like when he turned face, believe it or not, because I thought it was cool that he became like this badass again.
Yeah.
And then he disappeared. But yeah, overall, I think I'm sure all three of us here agree Shamrock was a missed opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
And folks, I don't want to ever miss an opportunity to tell you to check us out on Twitter at OVP Podcast. You can go to our website now. Quinn, that's up and running, right?
Yep, it's up. OVPPodcast.com.
Quinn, where can they subscribe?
They can subscribe on iTunes, the Stitcher, Google Play, all that stuff.
MySpace yet or no?
Not the MySpace.
No MySpace
yet. We keep piping it, but it's not coming.
Damn it. Well, anyway, so we will be back right after this.
Ken Tomohiro's impression of the Big Boss Man. Kentucky Fried Chicken's impression of the Big Boss Man. Ann Wood's impression of the Ultimate Warrior. Kentucky Fried Chicken's impression of the Ultimate Warrior. And you can only make these impressions with WWF Power Stamps. There's Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior, Big Boss Man, and Macho King Randy Savage for 99 cents each. Collect one each week only at Kentucky Fried Chicken and make your own impression.
And welcome back to OVP Podcast, the Retro Wrestling Podcast. We're actually talking with a very special guest today, Mr. Scott Keith. Thank you for joining us again, Scott. We really appreciate that.
Hey, you're very welcome, guys.
Thanks.
So our next segment is the overrated, and this one is going to be given to Michael Quinn. He's going to tell me and Scott something that he thinks is overrated. Quinn, what do you have in store for us today?
So I think this one, Joe, you may agree with me, but I don't know about Scott, so here we go. I've always thought that the Legion of Doom, the Road Warriors, are overrated.
Oh, I want to hear why.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so I mean, I grew up more a WWF kid.
So did I.
So, and you know, I wasn't around for their prime,
yeah,
per
se. Yeah, the NWA prime, right?
Right. But I definitely went back and watched the stuff. Mm-hmm. When I first got into wrestling, I watched all the tapes and all that stuff. And I don't know. I always liked Demolition better, first and foremost, so I'll start there.
I'm gonna agree with you. I always did too. That might be because we were WWF guys.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
But then when they come into the WWF, and I understand that they had a great run in NWA, and I've seen some of the stuff, and I get they're impressive and all that. But they come into WWF, and I mean, I've told you this before, Joe. The way they came in, they like look at Demolition and they like lose the belts. Like, there's that silliness. And then there's like other problems. Like, I just feel like they fight the Nasty Boys to win the titles, and
no, they
didn't. They beat the
Nasty
Boys at SummerSlam.
Right, they beat
the Nasty Boys at SummerSlam.
My bad.
And I don't know. They just seem to be in there. Like, I didn't like them as the standard bearer of like tag team wrestling at the time. And then they come, and then like after that run and everything, they come back at like WrestleMania 8, and they got a puppet. And then there's some other things too. Like, I have a problem with Ellering. Like, I never...
The WWF Ellering or Ellering in general?
Ellering in general.
Why you don't like the promos he gives?
I guess I just don't get it. Like, they're like, he's so smart, and
his gimmick. He was smart.
He's so smart, but I don't really understand what the hell he's talking about. He's in NXT now, and I still don't know what he's talking about. So maybe, Scott, you can enlighten me, because I really don't get the Legion of Doom. And there's various other things, like the whole Drunk Hawk.
Well, that's...
Drunk Hawk, yeah, that's different. Yeah.
That's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Ellering is a smart guy. Ellering's deal is that he is... he's actually a hell of a worker. But yeah, as a manager, he wasn't necessarily so great. But he was legitimately their business manager.
Oh, true.
Which is why, yeah, so that's why he was around for so long with them, just because he kind of kept them going, basically, from a business standpoint.
Gotcha.
I of course had NWA very early in my wrestling career, watching them. So I mean, I understand they were scary guys. Like they were totally different from anybody else on the scene at the time. That's kind of the way you have to think with them. By the time they got to the WWF in 1990, there was a whole host of Road Warrior imitators, three or four of which were wrestling for WCW at that point after they left, because they immediately tried to replace them with Maximum Overdrive and, what the hell the other guys
were. The Powers of Pain one of them?
Powers of Pain were that was kind of WWF's own version of bringing in the Road Warriors. Vince McMahon was trying to get the Road Warriors for years and years. Like, that was a long-standing rumor ever since 1984, basically, when they debuted, that Vince wanted them.
Yeah. I guess I just asked that because I knew the Powers of Pain started in WCW, and, you know, when I go back and watch some of those old WCW episodes, they're on there, so...
When they were in WCW, their purpose wasn't to imitate the Road Warriors, it was to feud with them. But then when they went to the WWF, their purpose was very specifically to imitate the Road Warriors and replace them. Dave Meltzer explained it in the Observer that Vince basically felt that the fans were so stupid that they would, you know, they could squint their eyes and think that they were watching the Road Warriors.
That sounds like Vince to me.
That sounds like Vince.
Yeah.
So that explains the haircuts being identical to Hawk and Animals, right?
That's exactly the idea.
So, Scott, is it true that, and I'm sure it is, but you probably have more insight than me, that Demolition truly was supposed to be Vince's original, that was his counteract, or that was his version of the Road Warriors? Is that a rumor, or is that really what he was going for?
No, that's what he was going for, I was going through the Observers at the time. That was kind of his idea.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say, Scott, though, I would wonder what, as someone that saw LOD Road Warriors initially, did you like Demolition? Like, because I always loved them.
Huge fan of Demolition. Yeah. The thing is, though, that Vince kind of intended them as Road Warriors, but they never were. Like, Bill Eady is obviously, you know, well, Bill Eady's a much better worker than either one of the Road Warriors.
Very true, yeah.
You know, and the team worked as a totally different type of team. Like, they weren't the overpowering blitz the jobbers team. Like, if you go back and watch
Like, the best way to really appreciate what the Road Warriors did was to go back and watch the episodes of, you know, WCW Saturday Night that are on the network.
Right.
You know, when you had all the literally the 15-second squashes where the Road Warriors would come in and find that they'd find the two skinniest, you know, geekiest looking jobbers with no tan and no muscle tone, just throw them in there just to get murdered by Hawk. And it was glorious.
Yeah. And that's the whole point of them. I'm not going to lie. I love the – I've said it on – past episodes. I love the idea of the squash match.
Yeah.
And I can get why definitely Lena Doom with the finisher that they had with the clothesline.
Oh man, that was such a great finish.
That looks great on jobbers. But
absolutely.
I guess,
Billy Parks or whoever they're playing.
Yeah, you know.
The thing is too, like they came in 1990, and I mean by that point they were 2 years overexposed in the NWA and WCW as it was. I mean when they finally won the tag team titles in 1988. Like, that was pretty much the end of the line for them as far as being a top draw. They turned babyface again, but by then, they were a really expensive pain in the ass for Jim Herd.
I was going to say, I had heard that they had outrageous demands for money.
Oh, yeah, it was completely ridiculous. Like, they had to go. By the time they got to 1990, it was literally Jim Herd was begging them to leave, and they bought out their contracts just so that the – just so that they wouldn't stick around anymore.
Wow.
And I mean, they had equally outrageous demands in WWF. And it got to the point where essentially they were going to go live in Japan for 16 weeks of the year. But Vince was in such a bad position that he had pretty much nobody as far as top baby faces went in 1990. Like, it was a really rough year with Ultimate Warrior on top and everything like that.
Yes,
so they kind of had some bargaining power.
Right.
Originally, when they came in, too, he actually had planned that they would remove they didn't want face makeup on, right? They were actually going to take off their makeup and grow out their hair.
What?
And that was kind of one of the delays of coming in, because he wanted them to change their look because he felt like there already were enough people with painted faces and muscles.
Oh, that's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so.
But, okay, like, what you're telling me, though, is it seems like that they almost had a limited draw, like, it as far as years were concerned. And I guess what I'm saying is that they're remembered like this big thing, like they were like almost like they were around long or something, and they were, but I just feel like the majority of their career is just disappointing. Is that the right word for it?
They drew really big for a few years. Most of their prime was basically in the South from 83 to about 86. Like, that's where they'd – but the thing is, though, they didn't get stale because they didn't stay anywhere for long. They came into a place for, you know, they come in for a couple of months. They would destroy everybody, and then they would leave again. That was part of the problem. When they did the WWF, right, it's like, well, you come in, they run through demolition for that feud, and then said, well, what do you do with them from there, right? Because they're not going to do the crazy squashes like they did on TV to keep them – finding new interesting things to do all the time. So it's just, you know, how you just ran out of things to do with them right away, basically.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I couldn't stand what they did, the damage they had done to Demolition. I still feel
with Crush.
I felt like, you know, Crush wasn't that bad. They could have kind of continued on a little bit instead of going to Repo and all this, but you know, like I don't know. Like, and then Demolition gets the crappy music, and
yeah,
we've been over that. Well, yeah.
Yeah, that was. I mean, a lot of that too was Vince's vendetta against Bill Eadie at that point. He had the health problems, and they had they're falling out. So yeah, basically Vince's idea was, well, we're gonna. And actually, there was just to go off on another tangent about that. The point when Demolition got the masks, they took off the.
Yeah,
so that was actually really the start of the big split between Vince and Bill Eadie, because. Demolition had actually signed a deal with to go over to Japan, because they were actually getting very popular at that point, right? Because their feud was, you know, their career was kind of on the downswing in the WWF, and they figured they can go to Japan.
They would have been big
in Japan. But the thing is that the Japanese were very much into, you know, like the black leather masks and the spikes and everything like that, and the face paint, and that was really cool. And then Vince changed the gimmick. He put them under masks, and then basically, at that point, then the Japanese didn't want them, because it was essentially a different team, and that kind of killed the gimmick for them. So Eadie was very bitter about that, because it ruined that whole thing for him.
Yeah, I could see a split over that, definitely.
I could too. You know what always bugged me about that feud, the LOD Demolition feud, is that there was never, to my knowledge anyway, there was never just a proper LOD versus Axe and Smash, and I guess it's obviously because of what you're saying, Scott, with the Bill Eady fallout, but every Demolition LOD match that I've ever seen, whether it's on Coliseum video or anything like that, it's always the Crush version by that point.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And that sucked.
The plan had been, like, as far as where they were going with it, was that they wanted to come in and get the tag team titles on Road Warriors LOD really fast, actually.
Hmm.
That was kind of the idea behind the Phantom title switch with the Hart Foundation and the Rockers.
Okay.
So the Rockers were supposed to get titles, and it was supposed to pass them to either back to Demolition and then to LOD, blah, 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 right? So that was kind of where they were going with that. They wanted to get the belts off the Hart Foundation one way or another and get them back and get them to the LOD really quickly.
Okay.
Which is really weird because they then did not end up getting them for like almost another year after that.
Yeah, it was so long.
So, yeah, it was kind of a whole strange thing with them like that. But that had been the idea at the time.
Before we go too far on the Demolition thing, I also wanted to say, I mean, the other thing that I always think about them with is that LOD 2000 deal.
Oh.
I mean, like, when it first happened, I think, I don't know about you, Scott, I don't know about you, Joe, even either, but I thought that was going to be pretty cool.
So did I.
And
we were 13, so
yeah,
I mean,
it's... But it just fell apart, like, immediately. Like, do you know what happened there? Like...
That was mostly Hawk and his problems, okay, basically.
So his real life problems were then turned into a storyline,
right?
That's right. Yep.
With the drunk Hawk angle,
and then it jumps off the Titantron and all that.
Jump off Titantron, yep, exactly. Yeah, I mean, because the long game there was like they really did want to replace him with Draws. Like that was always where they were going with the whole thing.
Draws. Yeah, I remember Puke being in there.
It's Puke.
Yeah, Draws was essentially brought in to take over in the team, and
Vince
Hawk.
Really thought that was going to be.
He thought that was that draw the people would be buying goddamn Puke and Animal t-shirts. And
well, you know,
little kids puking in buckets at ringside and shit. You know?
Well, remember Beyond the Mat? He's like all excited
he's
about.
Got a puke.
He's got a puke.
He's got a puke. Yeah, just little foam puke buckets for the kids. Yeah. You know. Foam nipple rings.
Vince really on the pulse of the people there.
Yeah, definitely. He was on top of that. One thing I wanted to bring up, too, about LOD, I do agree with you, Quinn. I didn't get the appeal. Scott's done a very eloquent job clarifying their appeal in the NWA at the time.
NWA awesome, WWF sucks. There you go.
Yeah, seems to be the consensus.
But I will not lie, and again, this brings up the Manhattan Center Raw from February 97. I was very excited as an 11-year-old fan at the time when they returned at the Manhattan Center Raw.
Yeah.
That was awesome. I was like, yeah, LOD is back. This
and that
is great.
The music hit.
But then they just immediately torpedoed into the tag team scene. I think they killed the Godwins. They broke Henry Godwin's neck, I think, in real life. Right, Scott?
Yep, they sure did. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they kind of just were the LOD again for a bit. And then I loved it when the New Age Outlaws.
Yes.
I really did.
I was
going to
say.
Go ahead.
I was going to say something about that. I felt like it was exciting at first.
Yep.
But then you realized it was like, no, these guys are from like
it's the
10
LOD.
Years
yeah,
ago.
Exactly.
Like, what? Like, why are they just wrecking? Just absolutely wrecking these new dudes. It was a very exciting thing that like that the New Age Outlaws beat them. Right? What do you think about that, Scott?
Yeah, well, that was very much Vince Russo and his obsession with like you know the new guys beating the old guys, which it there certainly is something to new guys beating the old guys like that's
right.
You know if it's done well and it's built up, but I mean,
I think
Russo was too much. It was they you know destroying them. If you go out there and you mock them and have them you know go out and look like complete losers and then the New Age Outlaws beat them, it's like well then what you know what'd you be? You beat a bunch of losers, right?
Yeah,
like you know true. How does that get anybody over?
Good point.
Yeah, I don't know. I was at that point I was done with them, so I guess it was one of those cases where I was happy about it. But you're right. Yeah, it's if you completely denigrate them like,
and then you beat them. Yeah, that's the old wrestling adage. You know, just if you make your opponent look like you know an idiot, and then
if you make your opponent look like an idiot, you beat an idiot.
Exactly. Right? What good did you do?
But I think the times that we were in at that point really softened that.
Yeah,
like, you know what I mean.
It was the beginning of the Attitude Era, or at least like right on the cusp of it.
Yeah, it wasn't played out with Russo destroying the old guys too much yet.
No, it was a new concept,
exactly.
And I always also like just to continue that train of thought. when the Outlaws, in turn, a few years later, got destroyed by the Dudleys in early 2000. It was like a nice, like, bookmark.
Yeah, the Outlaws were so beyond stale at that point, and yeah, that was one of the, that was a nice little pass in the torch thing.
Yeah.
They had, but that's the thing, though, is they had been built up as Triple H's, you know, heavy tag team, right? That was behind them, and they got the big push again, and all of a sudden, just bam, the Dudley boys beat them, and then they were gone.
They didn't
stick around the tag team division either. They eventually left.
They eventually came back and got squashed again by the Shield, if you remember.
Yeah, well,
that was awesome too.
Yeah, that was good too.
That was great.
And you know, Billy Gunn's like 53 years old, and he's going to be doing the Japan Tag Team Tournament in a couple of weeks.
Oh,
like,
is he coming back again? Wow!
Oh my God,
I missed that.
The one Billy Gunn, Scott. I know you love that run back in 2000.
Billy Gunn and Yoshitatsu are going to be a tag team. Oh yeah, I know.
Yeah,
they're gonna lose every match.
I saw one thing with Yoshitatsu since he came back. He doesn't seem like he's the same. I don't know.
Well, I don't think so. No, he's been terrible since he came back.
Yeah, because his neck or whatever.
So we're gonna move on now straight into our underrated segment, folks. And this one, I think it's underrated because I think a lot of people like to crap on the match quality. But I love, 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 love Coliseum video tapes. I'm talking your WrestleFest 90, your Battle of the Superstars, your Rampage 91.
Definitely.
Your Best of the WWF Volume fucking 13. I remember, Scott, I'm sure you can relate to this, my affinity for these tapes, because I remember as a young teenager reading your reviews of your Coliseum video rants, and you just, like, you warmed the cockles of my heart, because I was like, I can relate to this shit. Of course the matches are bad. Yeah, sometimes you'll find a hidden gem, actually. But of course the matches are bad. Of course it's just to make money. Of course it's just to use this footage that you've taped at, you know, TV tapings and
or house shows.
Recycled house show stuff. Of course it's Sean Mooney and Alfred Hayes on commentary for a lot of it. But there is just such a charm and appeal to me to these Coliseum videotapes, regardless of the match quality, regardless of the minus five stars,
minus
like Brian Alvarez would say.
Stars.
You know, I don't care about that. I like the dulcet tones of Alfred Hayes and Sean Mooney guiding me through this Haku versus British Bulldog match. I like, you know, like, what do you think, Scott? What do you think of the Coliseum tapes? You reviewed enough of them.
Well, yeah, geez, of course. Yeah, you know where I stand on that for sure. I wish I put them all in the network. The thing is, you know, I mean, as when I first started renting them as a 12-year-old, right? Like, it was you're watching, you know, WWF Superstars of Wrestling or Maple Leaf Wrestling, as we called it up here, and you know, you get like British Bulldog squashing a couple of geeks, and you know, Haku squashing some geek, and then you know, Iron Sheik squashing some geek, and that's all you ever get on TV. And then you watch this Coliseum videos.
Right,
it's like,
yeah,
holy fuck! Here's like, you know, Iron Sheik against the British Bulldogs from Boston Garden. Like, holy crap!
Yeah,
like, you know, like this is stuff you would, like, you know, we got like, you know, one or two host shows a year in Vancouver, but like,
right,
you know, it, aside from that, right, you get all these crazy mind blowing matchups that you would never even think of, and
oh,
you know,
yeah,
like you know, this. You're exposed to all this stuff that, you know, that like lumberjack matches and cage matches and things you don't see on TV.
Just a bunch of oddities, basically.
Just a bunch of oddities, yeah. Like, you know, back before, you knew they had 3 hours of Raw to fill every week, and you know, they would throw every crazy shit at the wall to fill time with it, right? Like, you used to have to pay for these things, and it was fantastic. It was, you know, just because the product was not overexposed, and it was just, you know, it was. I still love to go back and watch them. And like, as you say, they have a real charm about them. The fact that they are thrown together so haphazardly is a grab bag, right? Like,
yeah,
you know,
it really is.
And you're
like,
right.
It's like a box of chocolates.
you're totally right. And it has that feel of like this was thrown together in Fairfield, New Jersey.
07-007.
07-007. And they just put it's Mooney in a studio. I mean, there's some great memories I have with them. Like, I love the, is it the, WrestleFest one where Mooney's like sweating profusely?
That's
like,
hottest matches.
Or hottest matches, yes.
Matches, yeah.
And all that nonsense. And just like Lord Alfred Hayes on a train, like traveling through Europe. Like, and
yeah.
And
the Star Trek one, Invasion 92. Remember that one, Scott, with the Star Trek theme?
For sure. Like they used to have fun with with all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And it wasn't even like, you know, the kind of the deliberate comedy they're writing now, right? You know, it's just they're just goofing around and they go out there and doing this kind of stuff off the cuff, right? Yeah, they didn't take themselves seriously at all with it, especially when you had like, you know, Bobby Heenan out there, you know, clowning around on them like that with
Johnny Polo actually had a Johnny few Polo, where he was hilarious,
great.
Yeah, and I mean, and you know, Johnny Polo, of course, was producing behind the scenes as well that stuff, right?
Wow, so I didn't know that. Yeah, interesting. Because he feels like he's looser in
he's
he's like making fun of Gorilla like
the whole time,
like, but not in a almost like it's a performance kind of way. Almost like he's like muttering under his breath and like kind of like making fun of Gorilla in such a way where he doesn't know he's being made fun of because he's older.
It's like, true.
Yeah, exactly.
It's true.
I think Vince really liked Johnny Polo actually as during that period. Speaking of missed opportunities, I mean, like, you know, obviously he wanted to have an in-ring career and go on as Raven and do all that stuff. But my God, like, they were basically offering him, you know, a producer position behind the scenes at that point.
He could have been a commentator. Yeah,
he could have been a commentator. You know, he could have written TV. He could have been Vince Russo. Like he wanted to continue wrestling on and went on and did it. But yeah, like he could have been like a head office guy these days if he'd stuck around in that position like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like, do you want to like sacrifice the great Raven stuff in ECW
for that thing.
Johnny Polo stuff? It's both good. It's both great. But
yeah,
I love Johnny Polo. Yeah. I never got Raven. So you know, hey, you know, screw Raven.
You weren't like a big grunge rock fan, Scott. You know,
I was a grunge rock fan, but I mean, I don't know. The character was weird.
What do you think of that fun stuff though in WCW with him, where I think Stevie's like at his house, but he's rich.
Oh yeah,
that was kind of funny.
That was later on. That was with the Jersey Triad.
Yeah, it was almost like they combined the Johnny Polo backstory with the Raven character in WCW. Like they brought it all together. You know, he's a rich, disturbed kid.
Yeah. That's so great.
That was kind of cool. But back to Coliseum Video. Yeah. There are some hidden gems there. And Scott, you know, as you know, you've reviewed tons of these. And I've read them many times in my heyday. And Quinn, you've watched a ton of them with me and without me.
Yep.
There are some hidden gems there. One of my favorite Coliseum Video matches is this awesome unsung match from January of 94. It is the Hart Brothers versus the Steiners. It's on WrestleFest 94. Remember that one, Scott?
Oh, of course. That's one of my favorite matches of all time.
What a match.
Oh, yeah. First time I ever saw a Steiner screwdriver, I nearly shit my pants. It was just fantastic.
I'll have to go back and watch that. I think I read somewhere about that recently,
too. Well, I mean, and imagine if you will, right? Like, you know, Scott Steiner goes take, you know, says to, is talking to Owen Hart backstage. He's like, yeah, I want to lift you up in a suplex position and then drop you on your head in a pile driver. And, you know, you just imagine Owen's just like, all right, let's do it.
Yeah. A seated pile driver.
Because he goes out there
driver.
And he takes that thing with gusto.
He does, man. And that's a nasty move. That's a seated pile driver. That's not that's not a tombstone, you know, where you're...
Scott Steiner is not known for protecting his opponents.
No.
No way. Yeah.
Not at all. That match is awesome. It has a double DQ ending, if I recall correctly, but the Steiners egg on the Harts to come back and fight more, so they do.
Which tape did you say that was on?
WrestleFest 94.
There is another match on there too, if I'm not mistaken. That was also awesome. But yeah, it's
Brett Diesel. No,
I think it was something with the Click and the Hart. But there was a couple on WrestleFest 94, if I'm not mistaken. Like the Harts Steiners one is the like you know the big one, but there was another one on that was great too. But
you guys seem to be more knowledgeable in the Coliseum tapes than I am, but I did watch plenty of them. But
yeah.
I'm saying, do you guys think the match quality kind of went up on those kind of after? I would say post when that
92.
Flair was like beat or Flair lost to Brett on
I do
the
notice,
Coliseum tape.
I do notice that starting in 92-ish that there are some better matches. Like the Brett-Flair matches, you know, was only available on Coliseum Video at the time.
Yeah, that was weird.
I believe that was in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
That was in Saskatoon, yes. Unfortunately, I was not living in Saskatoon.
No, you were. Were you in Edmonton?
I was still in Edmonton, you betcha. Yeah.
Huh.
So
kicking myself. The quality had to change because the television product was changing. Like with WCW was putting on more competitive matches every week, and then WWF had to follow suit. And then at that point, then it's like, well, why am I watching Coliseum Video? Because this is the same stuff you get on TV.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Good point.
So they had to step it up.
That videotape, Smack 'em, Whack 'em.
That's a great one.
That has the Brett Flair match.
Brett Shawn Ladder match.
The Shawn Ladder. That's probably my favorite from Coliseum.
One of my favorite segments ever. Quinn and I love this one. Cooking for the Single Man with Yokozuna. Yes. We love that.
It's so unintentionally funny, which is that I get a kick out of it every time. It's just like Yoko's like moving Gene's hand towards the oven, but like it's not really mentioned. And like
there's these all subtle things about it. Fuji's having the time of his life.
Fuji's being a jerk, but not really. Yeah.
I mean, speaking of underrated, Mean Gene was just like, what a straight man for these things, right?
You know,
like
man.
He knew the deal, right?
Like, yeah.
You know.
Gene, yeah. Mean Gene was, in my mind, the best at any – he's the best one of the Mean Gene types that there's ever been.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the great thing about Mean Gene, too, was that you'd have these wrestlers who would go out there and forget their bullet points and, they'd stray off course and Gene would just bring them right back like the laser beam, right? You know, like just –
fantastic.
Back on course,
it's like he could fill the gaps. I was actually watching over again. You know when Elizabeth has to like pick what side she's going to be on?
I don't know who I'm going to pick.
Oh, yeah. She starts straying off, and there's a distinct point where Gene like kind of rings her back in. And I just noticed that the other day, and I'm just like, I just miss Mean Gene
stuff. He had one of our favorite lines from Rumble 92, which is, put that cigarette out!
Which
we love. And Scott, actually, speaking of Coliseum Video and underrated, in our first episode, Sean Mooney was my underrated, actually. I actually really like Sean Mooney. What do you think?
Yeah, Sean was good at what he did.
Don't you think?
There was a weird period where he brought in his twin brother Ian Mooney, and I never really understood what the gag was there that they were going
for.
We
covered that.
We've actually, believe it or not, Scott, you're not alone. We have covered Ian Mooney. I have on my soundboard here, I have the Ian Mooney soundbite from Wrestling Spotlight.
It's amazing.
I don't know what that was about. I don't know why there was an Ian Mooney, but there was definitely a period of time where this is what you heard.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ian Mooney.
And I don't know what it was about. I don't know why there was...
Yeah. I don't know. Did you see Sean Mooney on the Edge and Christian show on the WWE Network?
I saw a clip of it.
I saw some pictures.
He was pretty funny on there too, actually. So yeah,
he was that guy. Was a team player. He
absolutely was for sure. Yeah.
He knew his role. And go ahead, Quinn.
I was just going to say, you know who's another like MVP of those tapes is Lord Alfred.
I love Lord Alfred.
As we're talking about this, for some reason, I'm remembering some funny segment where Lord Alfred's teaching table manners to the Brooklyn Brawler
and Sherry.
Yeah,
and that is such a silly segment, but I know it's corny, but I just can't help myself but love it.
No, it's so good. I love Lord Alfred. He was this, like, he wasn't truly a heel.
What? Yeah.
But he leaned towards the heel. That's the impression I got. I don't know about you, Scott. He leaned towards being a heel, but he wasn't really like a heel. What do you think?
Well, back when he was wrestling, he was absolutely a heel.
Oh, yeah.
He was one of the best.
I knew about that too.
Judo Al Haize. Yeah,
yeah. Judo, yeah.
Yeah, Judo Al Haize. Yeah, no, he was great. But
as a commentator.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was always like a slight air of snootiness about him, especially if you watch like the rest of the Tuesday Night Titans shows. He's playing the sidekick, and he has this air of somebody who's well above this station in life, putting up this shit from this point.
He also, they cranked up his heelness during his last year or so, like 93-94.
That was a really weird period.
That was weird. Yeah. And then I think the last thing he ever did, have you ever seen, Scott, the Donnybrook Theater?
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
It's awful, bro.
Don't see it.
Yeah, don't seek it out. But we stumbled on it.
On the network?
No,
no,
it wasn't.
Sorry.
It was that Classics On Demand thing
on
that
cable.
Was briefly available.
And it's like a 10-minute pilot for like some fucked up variety
show.
It's
hosted by Pettengill, I think.
Todd Pettypoop.
Yeah.
And but Alfred Haize is the announcer, but it's from 95, so it must be his last appearance. And I just thought it was interesting. But
it's bizarre.
To close out this segment before we go to break here, I think the Coliseum videos, again, if you're looking for some like edge of your seat pay-per-view, you're in the wrong place. But if you're looking for some goofy ass theme, maybe, or some thrown together fun grab bag matches with a lot of fuck finishes, you know, DQs, you know, all that stuff. But it's fun because you don't know what you're going to get, because no one really memorizes the Coliseum video lineup. There's like hundreds of them, right. So no one really knows.
And I don't know if that would translate now to the modern fan, people who weren't around then, but...
I don't know either.
I think it would kind of translate to like the people who, like myself, were part of the tape trading scene in the 90s. Because that's kind of the natural extension of the Coliseum video grab bag stuff, right? Where you'd get all these compilations of shit from people online, right? And I think there might be something to that now, like making your own playlist on WWE Network or something along those lines.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you could do that too. That's true. They're very interesting and they're very fun. And like you said, Scott, about tape trading, I remember when I first got into wrestling, I used to actually trade with Joe here tapes. And those Coliseum tapes were treasured.
Because you never knew what you were going to get.
Yeah.
And it was fun. And speaking of never knowing what you're going to get, we'll be back right after this.
Well, it's become a ritual. This is how the 505-pound Yokozuna maintains his weight. I understand he consumes 15,000. Yes, you heard me right. 15,000 calories a day. And you contend this is what he has to do to maintain his strength and endurance. Well, what's with the knife? That knife looks to me like it's very, very sharp.
Yeah, it is.
How long have you been doing this?
How about 6 years?
6 years. What are we going to have here tonight, Lou?
A ribeye steak?
Fuck it!
And welcome back to Our Vantage Point, the retro wrestling podcast. It's just about time for our last segment here. Before we get to that, just want to remind you, hey, if you're listening now, tweet at us, OVP Podcast, or you can email us at ovppodcast@gmail.com. That is ovppodcast@gmail.com. Quinn, where can they subscribe?
They can subscribe on the iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, all the regular...
Player.fm, apparently.
I don't even know how we got on that one. I don't know what that is. I didn't even submit anything.
I'm not even sure what that is. And, of course, we are joined by Scott Keith from the Blog of Doom. It's incredible. Scott is with us, I hope. You still there, Scott?
Yeah. I'm still there, yeah. I'm fighting off all these expatriates who are knocking on the door here trying to get into the country.
I don't blame them. So it's time, unfortunately, because this hour has flown by.
Yes, it has.
But it is time, and I could do this for hours and hours, but I have to go to work tomorrow. It's time for the Then and Now, and this, folks, if you haven't caught on by now, is where, you know, when you're a wrestling fan for, let's say, 20-plus years or maybe 30 years like Scott, your perspective can change from when you saw something at the time versus what you think of it now. So, Quinn, I'm going to throw to you. What do you have for a Then and Now?
Okay, so this one, I really don't know where it's going to go with you two, so I'm kind of excited about it, but... I thought it was apropos at the time, because we're nearing Survivor Series,
okay,
to talk about a certain event that we've put off a little bit.
This must be Ludwig Borga and Lex Luger.
No.
Ah, damn. The casket match, Yoko Undertaker.
No.
Damn.
I thought it would be a good time to talk about the Montreal Screwjob.
Oh, God.
And changed perspectives on it.
Okay, so...
And that's really what I wanted to focus on more.
Quinn, I'd like you to set the stage for me.
The stage really is this, is that Brett was going to go to WCW, right?
Yep, that was agreed upon.
He had signed with them, I believe, already, yes?
He had, yep.
Yep. And there was going to be one final match. He was the champion at the time.
He was.
And he would be facing... his arch rival, Shawn Michaels.
Your favorite.
In Montreal. And if I know my history right, there was supposed to be some kind of schmoz, as Brett likes to call it, in Wrestling with Shadows. Or there was supposed to be some other ending. And instead, Shawn puts him in the sharpshooter.
Ring the fucking bell.
Vince rings the fucking bell. And... you know, the whole wrestling world blew up in anger. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so what did you think at the time?
At the time, I was actually, as much of, I am admittedly a Shawn Michaels fan.
A huge one.
Right. But I was on Brett's side.
Okay.
Why? Why? Because I just felt it wasn't the right way to do business.
Okay.
But as the years have gone by, my opinion has really changed on the whole thing.
What do you think now?
I look at it as it's, you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the stage where this was playing out, and you know, the competition with WCW,
mm-hmm.
a couple years after the Medusa thing, which, you know, when that happened, I feel like I didn't fully, because I was too young, I think I didn't fully comprehend what was happening.
Nor did I.
And I can see where Vince was coming from.
Okay. So what do you think now?
What I think now is I think it was the correct decision. I think that Vince was in the right because this guy didn't want to do business with him. He wanted...
That was his boss.
And I understand that he worked with Brett for a long time and that, you know, maybe Brett wouldn't have left with the belt.
Yeah, I don't know
I don't
he
think
would've.
I don't think he would.
I really don't think he would have.
But you got Bischoff in the equation and
yep.
you never know what's going to happen. And
well,
I would like to hear what you okay. guys have to say about
before,
it.
Before I'll make a quick statement and then I'll throw to you, Scott.
Okay. Oh, I'll have things. Yeah.
I can't wait. No, that's good. Bret Hart is my favorite wrestler of all time, and Quinn knows that.
Right.
Anyone, you know, the six people that listen to this podcast, they know that. I love Bret Hart, and I'm with you, Quinn. At the time, I was on Bret's side. For many years, I was on Bret's side. Now, I am not really on so much a side. I get why Vince did what he did. I get it. I'm not saying I think it was the best thing to do, but as someone that, from what I know anyway, I'm not an insider, from what I know, he was his mindset was to protect his business at the time. They were in fierce competition still with WCW at that point in 97. He really didn't know if Bret Hart, you know, theoretically could have taken this title with him to WCW the next night on Nitro or whenever. I don't, you know. So I'll put it this way. I'm much more sympathetic towards what Vince did than I ever was. And I think that Bret should have just dropped the title. At the same time, I don't believe he ever would have taken the title with him. And I do believe him when he says he would have dropped it to Shamrock or Austin.
Anybody.
Or the Brooklyn Brawler at MSG. I believe him when he says that. But it's also almost 20 years ago. So, like, any bitterness that Bret might still be carrying on about losing a fake championship, I think he should let go at this point. So that's where I stand. I agree with you to that extent. Scott, what do you think?
Okay. So it's a very weird thing to look at it now from the perspective of, you know, there's probably fans now who weren't around for the screw job at the time. Probably don't understand why, you know, it's like, oh, well, he didn't want to lose a title.
Right.
Like, you know, big fucking deal, right? Like, you know, who cares? Guys lose titles every week, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, I mean, you know, obviously it was a much, much different thing back then. So that's a really weird perspective of the time. I mean, I can tell you at the time that it happened, people were very confused about it.
Yep.
I had lots of people who were casual fans basically coming up to me and being like, I watched the show last night. What happened? Like, what was that, right? It was, weren't angry part of the time. They just, you know, this was weird. Nobody had ever seen, like, this, you know, somebody get screwed over like that before. It was kind of strange.
Yeah.
So as far as him leaving and the belt, you were mentioning about Medusa, right? The, you know, dropping in the title. And, okay, so that was actually the precedent that ensured that Bret would not do that. Medusa dropped that title in the garbage can. And WCW got their asses absolutely handed to them in court over that. Jerry McDivitt sued them into the Stone Age for putting their intellectual property on WCW Nitro. And Eric Bischoff, to say that he got his wrist slapped by Ted Turner over that would be a gross understatement. Eric Bischoff would never have put the world title on Nitro after that. Eric Bischoff would have been basically fired from the company had that happened, because WCW almost got sued out of existence for doing that. That was a big deal.
Now, Scott, that leads me to another question, though. WWE did the same exact thing with Ric Flair a couple years prior,
yes.
if you recall.
Yes.
So
that's right. Yeah.
But didn't Flair own the belt?
No. No, the belt was owned.
Oh, he had a deposit on it. Sorry, yep.
He had a deposit on it. The belt was owned by the National Wrestling Alliance.
Right, right.
I guess what I was going to say is...
Did WCW sue over that?
Right. Was it the reverse position?
They did.
It was reverse position, exactly.
That led to the video distortion, yeah. Which really that wasn't...
The video distortion.
Yep,
and then
okay.
The tag belt right. Being the thing yeah. Or whatever. Yeah.
Okay, so back to...
Bringing somebody's belt onto another person's promotion has never led to anything good, legally speaking.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, so... All right, so the other thing as well is about how, you know, Vince didn't know if Brett was going to go to WCW the next night on Nitro, right? You're saying?
Yeah.
He couldn't have. Bret Hart had an agreement to begin to work for WCW, but that agreement did not go into effect until the first week of December.
Okay.
Bret Hart still under contract to the WWF until that point. Legally speaking, he could not have shown up on Nitro until then. And if that had happened, then again, legal Armageddon would have resulted.
You know what? That's I'm glad you brought that up, Scott, because that's true. Even though the screw job was November 9th, 97, Bret Hart didn't show up in WCW until mid-December before Starcade.
Yeah, a little bit
right.
Before Starcade.
Right. Good point. Good yes, point. That's
that is Brett, a good point. Brett, I didn't think of
Brett
that.
Brett did not
yeah.
have legal clearance to appear on WCW television. Now, the way that Vince tells it today, of course, is that he thought that Bret Hart was going to lose the title and then show up on Nitro the next night, which is, you know, that's that become the story over the years because that's the story that the WWF propagated.
Do you think that, like, again, because the times were so chaotic, though, that Vince even with all the legal mumbo-jumbo and everything, that Vince could have had some kind of concern because, you know, WCW made money. It's not like they couldn't afford to pay that kind
yes.
of thing.
Yes, Vince was paranoid as fuck at that point. So yes, I'm not surprised at all that in Vince's mind, that's what he was doing. But I mean, okay, so here's my question though. Why did Vince put the world title on Bret Hart in the first place if he knew that he was leaving and he was going to breach the contract?
Well,
like that's the thing that really gets me, right? Like why even do that then? Why even put yourself in that position?
If I recall the timeline, and I don't know if it's Dave Meltzer's, which if it is, it's probably accurate, or if maybe it's Bret Hart's own timeline or just whoever, I don't believe that Vince said to Bret, at least, I don't know when he knew it, obviously, but I don't believe he revealed to Bret that he couldn't afford to pay him, quote unquote, until September of 97, but he put the title on him in August.
Right. Exactly. I mean, if it's his mind, though, you would think he would.
Yeah, you would think he would know. Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I got you.
At the same time, it's not like he had any great plans for Bret as champion, right? Like he put
the
title on,
and he
immediately flips the promotion on Shawn Michaels and the Undertaker.
Yeah, exactly. And Bret was fighting fucking Del Welks, you know,
the Patriot. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I get what you're saying there. Why put the title on the guy? Why do you think Vince Scott? Do you think when he signed Bret to that 20-year contract in late 96, do you think he had any intention of fulfilling it?
I think at that point he might have because he was in such a bad position. He was very the feeling at the point when he signed it was Bret was going to jump to WCW. Like, it was going to happen. They had an agreement to go, right?
Right, right.
You know, Vince was up against the wall. And you know, that's the solution that he came up with because he couldn't match WCW's money. So he came up with the 20-year plan to do it instead.
Right.
I think in his mind he was going to do it, but it's Vince McMahon. His mind changes constantly, right?
That is true. And so a year later, especially back then, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially back then, right? And so a year later, he was regretting it. But I think in Vince's mind, if Bret Hart had shown up on WCW TV in 1996, that would have been, you know, a dagger through his heart, basically.
That might have been game over.
Absolutely.
Because I could even see – once Bret goes, I mean, you kind of only have Sean carrying it. And
that
then,
was it, really.
And then what's to prevent WCW from offering Sean $10 million
sure
or whatever they
Scott,
how
you,
much, however
they did,
it was.
Yes.
They did, right?
Yeah. A lot, yes.
I'm sure they did, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. So, I mean, so Scott, okay, we have to wrap up shortly here. I'll be a little liberal with the time. I think Quinn got some extra airtime for us. But, Scott, what do you think should have happened? If you're God, right, and you can just control what happened at Survivor Series 97 and the fallout from it, you know, where Bret goes and when, what do you do?
I would have done the whatever crazy DQ finish in the brawl, and then I would have had him drop the title the next night to, Steve Austin, or Steve Austin, Ken Shamrock, anybody. Ken Shamrock would have been fine, whatever.
Temporarily.
He'll be there the next night. Yeah, exactly. Have him show up, drop it to Shamrock. You can do DX interference, whatever. Boom, there you go. Next feud. The story goes the original thing that was pitched to him was, the four-way in December, whatever.
Yep.
I don't know if that was actually going to be a thing or not, but Or even Brett just didn't want to lose in Montreal on that particular night. He would have been fine losing it to Sean, later on even as well, right? So
I guess to close out, I just wanted to get from you, Scott, is just do you agree with what Vince did in the end? At the end of the day,
Well, let's say what you will, it turned the business around.
Yeah,
it created the Mr. McMahon care. So I mean, in the end, Vince was right.
Yeah,
that's where the business needed to go. And the thing is, if Brett had stayed around in that kind of role, he would have been a major roadblock on there.
Yeah, that's
true. He wouldn't. They wouldn't have gone there. And I'm not saying that I agree with the decision. I think it was kind of shitty on Vince's part. But I mean. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't argue with the results.
Yeah, you can't. Whether they were intended or not.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you think about it, if Austin was to be the lead, it would have been hard having Shawn and Brett around with Austin. And the Undertaker. And
assuming Shawn doesn't get injured either.
Right, and what I'm saying is that they almost kind of lucked out because Shawn moved out of the way because of the back injury, and then Austin was able to just
Shawn to the moon. Shawn could have especially 1998 Shawn.
Right.
He could have really roadblocked a lot of the Attitude Era.
It's true.
But instead, you got guys like The Rock and Mankind and Kane, even. Kane. Glenn Jacob. Isaac Yankum.
Yeah.
Was a main player. So I think the way it worked out, obviously, we know that now, almost 20 years later, it worked out.
Here's the thing in the end. I just wish WCW hadn't fucked it up so bad.
Yeah.
If Bret Hart had jumped over there and they had done the right thing and been like, hey, it's the uncrowned WWF world champion. We're going to put him in there against our world champion draw $1 billion, then that would have been fine. Everybody would have been happy.
Yep.
Bret Hart would have been world champion again, made millions of dollars, and shit would have been great.
Fresh opponents. Like that.
Yep, fresh opponents. We actually...
Fresh opponents...
It's true, Scott. A few episodes ago, our missed opportunity was Bret Hart in WCW. And everything you just said is absolutely right in my eyes. I mean, they, instead of having him come in as like this like fake ref for a Sting match, they should have had him fighting Hogan sometime in 98. They should have
had multiple matches with Hogan, ask me.
Sure.
That's the main thing. If the fact that Bret Hart hadn't been such a waste in WCW, then I don't think that it would have been viewed as such a career-killing thing for Bret Hart.
Good point.
Mm-hmm.
Montreal, if he could have bounced back, made millions of dollars, but, as usual, because WCW, right? WCW ruins everything.
Yep, and that's why they are no longer with us. And speaking of no longer with us, unfortunately, our time is just about run out here. We only have so much airtime we can do here. We are very thankful to have Scott Keith on with us. Scott, again, thank you so much. We really appreciate you speaking with us for this last hour. Don't forget, you can tweet at us at OVP Podcast. You can also email us at ovppodcast@gmail.com. You can also just go to our website, which is ovppodcast.com. You can subscribe, as Quinn has set up for us, the iTunes, the Google Play, the Stitcher, apparently Player FM now.
Yes.
But not MySpace yet. Folks, we are, again, Scott, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate that.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you so much. You can obviously be sure to check out Scott at blogofdoom.com, Podcast of Doom, although it's on the back burner. And again, folks, we love talking with you about wrestling, so let us know if there's anything you want us to talk about. What's your underrated, folks? What's your overrated? What's your missed opportunity? Let us know, and we will be sure to talk about it in our next episode. Scott, thank you so much again. We will we'll be happy to have you on some other time. If you're game with that, we are too.
For sure.
All right. So, folks, have a good day. If you've been listening to us at work, have a good rest of your work day.
Yep.
If you're listening to us on the drive-in, have a good drive-in, or have a good drive-out, or drive to Canada, apparently.
Yeah.
So long, folks.
See ya.
By the time Bret Hart stepped center stage for his matchup with Shawn Michaels at Survivor Series, he had apparently already closed the door on his WWF career.
Given my 30-day notice to WWF, and right now I'm under contractual review with both the WCW and the WWF. I'm leaning strongly towards going one way.
In the end, his actions spoke volumes. Let's cut right to the chase. 7 days ago at the Survivor Series, did you or did you not screw Bret Hart?
Bret Hart would definitely tell you, I screwed him. I look at it from the standpoint of the referee did not screw Bret Hart. Shawn Michaels certainly did not screw Bret Hart. Nor did Vince McMahon screw Bret Hart. I truly believe that Bret Hart screwed Bret Hart. And he can look in the mirror and know that. I have no sympathy for someone who was supposed to be a wrestling traditionalist not doing the right thing for the business that made him, not doing the right thing for the fans and the performers and the organization who helped make him what he is today. Bret made a very, very selfish decision. Bret's going to have to live with that for the rest of his life. Bret screwed Bret.